Let's get started, Richard, with your article about the situation in the Middle East and the way that you're describing the Israel's dead end in that article. What is your understanding and what are you trying to say in that article?
Okay, yeah, the purpose of that article was to draw a connection that I think will help people understand the Israel-Gaza horrors that we are living through. And I don't just mean Gaza, the West Bank, or the whole story there of that conflict. And what I link it to in this article is an experience of another settler colonialism, an attempt by a minority to take over a majority of people that are ethnically or religiously or otherwise distinct from them, to see whether I can draw some lessons. And to do that, I made use of a book I published many years ago, which grew out of my doctoral dissertation, that had to do with the colonialism practiced in the East African country of Kenya by the British. My book covers the establishment of the British colony in that part of the world. Britain had several colonies in Africa, as I think most people know, and several in the eastern part of Africa, which is where Kenya is located. Long story short, what the British did there was to arrive and to make a determination all by themselves that they were going to establish a colony based on settling British citizens in the highlands in the middle, the geographic middle of Kenya. The highlands have a very fertile soil. They have a very good climate. It was a logical place for them to do this. And they made the effort to determine what would be good to grow there and to what would be good to produce. And again, long story short, they determined that would be coffee, which to this day is an important export of Kenya around the world. And they produce particularly Arabica coffee, which is the highest quality among coffees. And theirs is even better than most. In order to do this, they expelled, they pushed away the Africans that had lived for centuries on this land. They put them in, they forced them out. I mean force, physical military force, and forced them into reservations, portions of land much inferior to the land they were forced out of. And very quickly, it was clear what the logic here was. The reserved areas, and the major group that suffered this was a tribal grouping, for those that might be interested, known as the Kikuyu tribe in that part of Africa. They could not survive on these reserved areas. There wasn't enough land. It wasn't a good enough quality. They weren't used to this kind of farming. This was an impossible way for them to survive. But of course, the British had the solution, which is, okay, you live on the reservation, and then every day you go to the coffee plantation and you work. And the coffee planters, the British settlers, paid your wages, which enabled you to get by. The government then came in, the British government, and taxed the wages. So it took back part of the money that the settlers pay. I mean, you have to laugh because the alternative, you'd have to cry. Because what it meant was that these abused, expelled Africans had to work for next to nothing to grow the coffee and then got taxed on their next to nothing so that the colonial government wouldn't have to tax the settlers, let alone the British people back home. So it was a desperate desire. By the way, all of this is explicit. I spent time in the British Colonial Office in London. I spent time in the British Museum in London, looking at all the records. And they all discussed it and they debated it. The British knew exactly what they were doing. Anyone who wants to excuse this nonsense by thinking that the British, and they love this phrase in England, muddled through, is nuts. They didn't muddle at all. They worked all this out. And that's why Kenya functioned as a commodity, as a colony. But eventually, and here's my point, this was an untenable arrangement because it was an immense exploitation of about 3 to 4 million Africans by a handful, a few thousand European settlers. And it produced tension and conflict and bitterness. The formal colony was established in 1895, and almost on schedule, 50 years later, in the early 50s, it blew up. And suddenly the African population was no longer having individual efforts to change the situation, or even small group efforts. It had a full-scale organized rebellion. And it was known as the Mau Mau Rebellion, was led by a very charismatic African leader named Jomo Kenyatta. And the British moved in to violently suppress the Mau Mau Rebellion. It was characterized in the most lurid terms you could imagine in the European press, which had it all set up as the rise of the savages who had to be put down by the benevolent British with their commitment to peace. So this war to make peace ended up with the victory of the British. They defeated the Mau Mau. They captured and imprisoned Jomo Kenyatta. It was one of those great ironies. It proved to the British that their situation was hopeless, because whatever they did, what this Mau Mau Rebellion had showed them was that the illusion that they could survive in a settler colonialism was an illusion. Because in the Mau Mau put down, it's true, only 33 settlers, I don't remember the exact number, a trivial number of settlers were killed, a very small number of European military were killed, and about 12 or 15,000 Africans were killed. So you have numbers that should remind you of Israel and the Palestinians. But the British had to face, they really had no choice, that what the Mau Mau had showed them is they would have to spend a fortune of money preparing for the next Mau Mau, which could happen at any time. The first Mau Mau they defeated, but they had learned how to fight. To repress the Mau Mau took the British 7 years, an enormous expenditure of money. And this was, remember, at a time when the rest of the British Empire, and particularly the center of it, namely India, had been lost to them. And they basically made the decision, they can't do this anymore. Because the prospect was for endless conflict, costing endless amounts of money, disrupting whatever that colony might hope to. It was a decision that you might say, let's cut our losses from what this is. And so even though they won the war, they ended up saying, okay, we're leaving. They released Mr. Kenyatta from jail, and he became the first president of an independent Kenya. And they've led their own life as a nation since that time to this moment that I'm speaking. And I hope I've given you a flavor. The transition to Israel should be fairly obvious, right? It's a settler colonialism. You plunk a group of mostly Europeans in the middle of a non-European community that's quite a bit larger. There's a bit of a difference that the Israeli percentage has grown and the Palestinian has shrunk, but it's still the case. The rest of it fits pretty well. And again, I would argue that what happened in October of 2023 was the rough equivalent of the Mau Mau uprising. You've now spent a fortune of money, dealt a blow to the Israeli economy from which it will take years to recover. Yes, you have the absurd imbalance between how many Israelis died and how many Palestinians died. But that is really like the African, and it doesn't change that what Israel is looking at now, having seen what Hamas could do, having now seen that Hamas could actually survive this onslaught that they unleashed on them, well, like the British, they are looking at an open-ended, when will this ever stop? And they have enough problems as a society adding this. And so I'm hoping that writing it up this way and drawing the parallels and making the equivalences might shed light on how to look at the Israeli phenomena and to see the dead end toward which it is moving and maybe come to some rational solution beforehand. Rather than, and this is directed as much at the Israelis in hopes they see it as it is to the Palestinians, because it does shore up the Palestinian notion that in the end, they will win.
Donald Trump's solution for the conflict in the Middle East, and the way he was talking about the Middle East and the United States taking over Gaza and maybe solving the situation for Israelis. There are two type of arguments right now. One says that Donald Trump wants to avoid Netanyahu's attack on Gaza to go after some sort of attack. And the other argument says that Donald Trump is doing everything that Netanyahu wants, even more than that. What's your understanding on what has happened?
Well, first of all, it's pretty clear that Mr. Trump, when he was speaking to this subject, was reading off cards that had been written for him, talking points. The widespread suspicion is that those were written by Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, who's always had his eye on real estate development in Gaza, and who basically constructed the Abraham Accords, the so-called Abraham Accords, between UAE, Bahrain, and Israel, with Morocco and Sudan also somewhat less involved, precisely in order to sideline the Palestinian issue, take it off the table, and proceed to make Israel acceptable in its region without dealing with the Palestinian issue in the way that the only way that can address that issue, which is self-determination. This has been a very consistent stand, and I would remind you that when Mr. Trump was in office the first time, he recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, contrary to many international legal decisions. Which left it to be an international city first, and then envisaged it as a divided city with the capital of the Palestinian state in East Jerusalem. He recognized the annexation of the Golan Heights. He moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. We have heard that in the campaign, his campaign for office this time, Miriam Adelson, the widow of the late casino owner, who once said that he was ashamed that he had worn an American Army uniform rather than an Israeli Army uniform. Very clear that he had no divided loyalty. He was loyal to Israel rather than the United States. She gave him apparently $100 million in return for a pledge to permit the annexation of the West Bank by Israel and the ethnic cleansing everywhere. So I agree with you. There are these two ways of speaking or speculating about what Mr. Trump is up to, but I don't have any doubt at all that he's just in the he's just trying to help Mr. Netanyahu complete the ethnic cleansing of Palestine that the Zionist movement has always wanted to carry out. And in the case of Gaza, well, he made two comments. One was with regard to Gaza, that once it was emptied, it would be redeveloped and turned over to the United States, which I find rather preposterous. But anyway, that's what he said. And that the Palestinians would be resettled somewhere nice. And the latest word is that since both Egypt and Jordan, as well as Indonesia, have turned down any resettlement of Palestinians, his people have been looking at Somaliland, Puntland in Somalia, two unrecognized self-declared independent regimes as a place to resettle the Palestinians, or alternatively in Morocco, presumably in return for a huge payment of some sort. But that's what we know about that. But the clear statement is about Gaza by him is entirely consistent with what Mr. Netanyahu has claimed, namely that he had assurances from Mr. Trump as Mr. Trump came into the presidency that he, Netanyahu, could restart the war of annihilation on the Palestinians at any moment of his choosing. The other thing Mr. Trump said, which was somewhat obscured because of the furor about Gaza, was that he would consider the Israeli annexation of the West Bank, which, quote, some people think is a good idea, unquote, he said, and make a decision in 4 weeks. Well, this goes back to the alleged payment of payoff by Mrs. Adelson for just that. So I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever that all of this is premised on the return of the Israeli armed forces to the war of annihilation and the extension of that, not just to Gaza, but to the West Bank.
With Donald Trump and his position and his solution for the conflict in the Middle East, many people are confused about what he was talking about. What's your understanding of that?
I'm right up there with them. I mean, my understanding is that he didn't pre-clear this with anybody. And I think there was a reason for that. You know, he has surrounded himself with some of the most pro-Israel, pro-Zionist Americans possibly. And if he had done the normal staff coordination processes, it would have leaked this to Benjamin Netanyahu in advance. The Israelis would have been given advanced copies. People would have met on the side and to pre-brief the Israelis. Apparently, Trump didn't tell anybody that this was happening, including Netanyahu, and took him by surprise. And you have to ask yourself, why? Why would that be the case? And I think the answer is that he was putting Netanyahu in his place and taking Israel off the playing board. Israel doesn't, according to Trump's plan, Israel's not a player. The Israeli army won't be involved. Israeli security won't be involved. Israel's not going to be in. And I mean, everything that Israel thought was going to happen with Gaza isn't happening under Trump's plan. So you have to ask yourself why that would be. Why would this president who has said he's a great friend of Israel, who has surrounded himself with Zionists and such, make a decision to humiliate Benjamin Netanyahu in front of the world stage and take Israel off the playing board? And I think it relates to a statement that he made, after his first term, where someone talked about Middle East peace process. And he said, look, there's two players here, but one of them doesn't want peace. And that is Israel. So he knows that Israel is the problem. And he knows that Benjamin Netanyahu is the problem, also. That's why he reposted Jeffrey Sachs's condemnation of Benjamin Netanyahu. Why would Trump do that if he was, you know, the compliant puppet of Netanyahu? Because he's not. He doesn't like Netanyahu. He recognizes that Netanyahu is the problem, not the solution. And so he did this. I mean, that's the only way to read this. There's no other way to read this than that. But then we can look at what he put on the table. It's so absurd, outrageous, and unrealistic that it's just not going to happen. Why would he do that? Why would Donald Trump make that his opening gambit? Because that's how Donald Trump always operates. I'm not saying it's always successful. I think he's going to find out that it isn't going to work in with the Russians. But on this state, let me ask you, I mean, it's a rhetorical question, but if Donald Trump had gone back to business as usual, that is, leaning heavy towards Israel for a solution, that means there would never be a solution, just more death and destruction, endless fighting. For the Palestinians, no hope whatsoever. For the Arab world, continued humiliation. And so he had to do something different. What he put on the table was completely different. It's unlike any proposal that's ever been put out there before. But it's not a solution. It's a proposal, meaning that he has swept the board clear. Now he's put his proposition on the table. And I think to get a seat at the table, you have to say more than no. I think to get a seat at the table, you have to say no, but here's an alternative. Here's a counter offer. And I think that's what's going on here. I think Trump is playing, a game that's so unlike normal statesmanship, so unlike, normal diplomacy, that people are just totally, bent out of whack over this. I don't take what he said literally. I don't read into anything he said, because none of that's going to happen. Literally none of it can happen. I view this as an opening proposition in order to get people to come in and say, okay, how do we solve this? You see, because you can't rely on the past tools. The past tools didn't work. Anybody wants to sit here and make a case that Trump should have just continued doing what everybody's been doing for 40 or 50 years, then you're saying you really don't care about the Palestinian people. I know people are going to say, well, Trump doesn't. He didn't, he's taking, he's not taking anything, people. Stop. He's not taking anything. The United States doesn't own Gaza. We're not putting troops on the ground. We're not driving 1.9 million people out. It isn't going to happen. None of that's going to happen. That's just Trump's opening game. And again, you have to rely on people who assess what others do for a living. Look for patterns of life, patterns of behavior. And Trump's past patterns of behavior, I think, are a good judge of what he's up to. Go back and look at North Korea and what he did with North Korea in his first term. Fire and fury, threatening nuclear war. Kim Jong-un, if you sneeze, if you dare do this, I'm going to blow you off the face of the earth. Boom. 6 months later, he's meeting with the guy. Three meetings, including one at the demilitarized zone, crossing over into North Korea to shake the guy's hand. I don't think anybody who heard Donald Trump speak at the United Nations said, that's how this ends. And I can almost guarantee you that how this ends isn't going to be anything like the statement made by Donald Trump in the White House. It's just an opening gambit. It's the way Trump does business.